You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Trouble in Paradise by Anna Peel. Planning how you will be received on Love Island is out of the question. It's impossible to even map out how you will behave. If you did have a game plan, Barton Hansen, the season 4 finalist, says, the producers are going to try and throw a spanner in the works. These derailments include the widely understood reality tools of selective editing and off-screen encouragement to engage in conflict, along with efforts to break up couples with cast changes. One reality production trick that Love Island is mostly immune to is frankenbiting, the practice of stitching together out-of-context quotes to fabricate a narrative. While most dating shows fold disparate moments into a coherent romantic arc, Love Island's real-time shooting schedule means action unfolds at a granularly natural pace. A sexually confident woman is sometimes rewarded by viewers for making big, game-breaking moves. Higgins came in midway through season 5 talking about how coupled boxer Tommy Fury gave her fanny flutters before successfully making her way to the finale with ballroom dancer Curtis Pritchard, who also gave her fanny flutters. Atwood, meanwhile, shrugs at her mixed reception in season 3. I've always been quite a Marmite personality, she says, comparing herself to the divisive umami toast spread. Atwood was in the bottom of several public votes before becoming a finalist and getting a spin-off series. People either get it and they like my delivery and my attitude, or they don't. I definitely push some boundaries, like having multiple relationships in there. The producer's job is to facilitate this drama. One of the challenges, and rare peeks into the outside, is the headline challenge, where tabloid display is read out loud, and contestants must guess which one of them those awful things are being said about. The headline challenge is very artificial, executive producer Tom Gould says. All the challenges are, but they're rooted in lived experience. People in their relationships and the outside world have to deal with rumors and gossip and friends saying things about them behind each other's backs. And then that becomes about, well, do I trust this other person? Cowles describes the central question of interpersonal faith by bringing up Casa Amor, a multi-day set piece in which the islanders, without being able to communicate with their partners, must calculate whether to stay in their original coupling or enter a new one. While they wait to see if their partner returns alone or holding hands with another person, contestants visibly tremble, hearts thudding so loudly they can be heard on their microphones. Casa Amor came from a notion of, what's the worst thing that can happen in your new relationship, Cowles says. Oh, when they go away on a lad's or a girl's trip, because you don't know what they're up to, and then you'll see an Instagram post and they're talking to another person, and that sends you off on sort of an anxiety trip. We're trying to replicate real life. This surreal, condensed approximation of the traumas of the real world is obviously stressful for cast members. Eliminations are unexpectedly timed and follow no set rules. Viewers might vote out an entire couple or an individual man and woman. The choice might be left to the islanders, who may or may not be able to confer about it beforehand. It is highly organized tumult. I think that's the skinniest I've ever been, purely because I just couldn't relax, Barton Hansen says of her time on the show. Though the producers describe their role as reacting to what happens in the villa rather than instigating it, their interventions heighten the proceedings in a closed environment they designed. Sometimes runners sit between people to pause a conversation because there are already too many dynamic interactions taking place at the villa. Producers often encourage a confrontation to be delayed so that there are dramatic foreshadowing talks with other castmates, or so the islander can get more worked up. It's building up throughout the day, Somerville says. So when you do have these conversations, they are probably going to end up being a lot different than they would have been earlier. Producers also intervene with Voice of God intercom objections if contestants are discussing the show in a meta way, including musing about how they might be perceived by the audience. Mark Schaller, Ph.D., a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, tells me that fame creates objective self-awareness. When someone knows others are watching them, they become focused on what those people are seeing, whether the observed party isn't as good as they thought they were, or as good as their observers think they should be. To escape the objective self-awareness of celebrity, one might engage in self-destructive behavior, like drinking or suicide. On Love Island, the newly famous are subject to judgments they aren't even allowed to acknowledge. Before each islander packs their swimwear and leaves the villa, they sit down with a publicity team and finally learn what the world thinks of them. If you do stuff that people talk about, even if it's negative, they're still talking about you, Atwood says, with the agnostic pragmatism of a professional person of interest. And then that multiplies your chances of having other work off the back of it, because TV producers will see that and say, okay, well, she's good entertainment, she's fun, we're going to book her. We're not going to book the girl that would sit back twiddling her thumbs for 6 weeks. The worst thing I could do is go on this show and be forgotten. Somerville was called a national treasure during the third season, but when he cheated on his Love Island partner, Gabby Allen, after leaving the villa, the UK media turned on him. You almost feel like the whole world is like judging you and judging your character, Somerville says. It was in the papers. I didn't want to walk down the street. You're like, how am I even going to come through this? You know to yourself, you're not a horrible person. You've not killed someone. But everyone else has kind of villainized you. Hornick posits that the relationship of this audience to contestants on Love Island is so basic as to be biblical. At every dumping ceremony, the public gets to deliver Judgment Day. Viewers have the opportunity to reward those who seek true connection. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love, quotes Hornick. And to punish those who want the attention of the public and the boohoo fast fashion conglomerate. There's a difference between, I want a partner who's going to love me and be my soulmate through life, Hornick says, versus a desire for wholesale adoration. The public can be brutal in exacting a distinction where there may not be one. On last summer's seventh season of Love Island, Jake Cornish became an immediate fan favorite by launching into a nearly season-long partnership with Liberty Pool, whose little white toes he very vocally admired. But doubt of Cornish's motives circulated among the cast and audience when he quietly suggested to Pool that she congratulate a friend one-on-one rather than with the other islanders, with the apparent intention of creating a scene that would yield more screen time. In other words, a television character was doing something specifically to generate more entertaining television. He was also under scrutiny for the timeline on which he meted out relationship milestones, which conveniently aligned with the show's narrative progression. Poole ended the relationship, and the pair left the villa 3 days before the finale. Cornish was savaged in the press and shunned after filming by the women of the house. He did not attend the cast reunion, saying, "It isn't nice I've been painted this way as a pantomime villain." Through a representative, Cornish declined to speak with Vanity Fair for this story because he is only accepting paid interviews. ITV's support For outgoing cast members includes guidance on financial responsibility and securing management. At virtually the same time in America, two couples on Bachelor in Paradise were evicted from the house by their castmates for not following the golden rule of paradise, being fully receptive to finding love. One couple, Brendan Maurice and Piper James, was flagellated on social media after discussing on camera how the show would impact their follower count. And for Maurice, seeming to lead another woman on so that he could maintain his place in paradise while he waited for James to arrive. Bachelor in Paradise's Wells Adams says that many contestants who all know each other from Bachelor Nation and are paid to appear on the show come to the beach with potential partners or nascent crushes. It's a process that's built into the production of Bachelor in Paradise. We need a gauge of everyone's interest in people, Adams says. However, when a relationship cements before filming starts, there's little use in appearing on a matchmaking series. The pageantry makes the agreed-upon contrivances of a love game show feel phony. On top of that, adds Adams, when you start talking about your followership on social media, then it becomes a little icky. I think that's where the audience really got upset. And it's understandable, because it's something that's so unrelatable. 99.97% of the people that watch the show have 500 followers and don't sell diarrhea tea for thousands of dollars, he says, about the not always inspirational, not always aspirational products influencers aspire to hawk. Rather than landing a miracle diet endorsement deal, Maurice lost a third of his 330,000 Instagram followers, and James lost more than 15,000 of her original 88,000. Social media is such a febrile atmosphere, Jane said in 2019, not long after Thalassitis and Graydon's suicides. Sometimes it's quite good to take a break from it. She didn't mention how you might avoid the platforms of your livelihood depends on them. Nor did she bring up Love Island's now-defunct Twitter game, which, like the headline challenge, forced islanders to hear often cruel posts with their names blanked out and guess which one of them was the subject. This past September, 2 weeks after Love Island's Season 7 finale, the Digital, Culture, Media, and Sports Committee of Parliament met with former Islander Amy Hart about how to prevent bullying on social media. Cast members had previously testified before the committee in the fall of 2019 during an inquiry about reality TV. Somerville told lawmakers that the worst period of doing Love Island was the subsequent exposure to real-world scrutiny. One of my death threats was traced back to a 13-year-old, Hart said, suggesting all social media accounts be linked to an identification number so that people can't anonymously hurl virtual abuse. You don't leave your morality at the door when you're producing a show, Cowles says, when asked about the show's responsibility to the celebrities it creates. But it's not that we make decisions in a morally calculated way. We do approach it in the same way that you would with a drama, where you'd want viewers to get the satisfaction of seeing a storyline wrapped up and ended. On Love Island, the only way to seem authentic is to submit to the artifice. You can do whatever you want in the villa, but what machinations are constructed to test you and what appears on television are entirely up to the producers. The levers of power are in their hands. Upon leaving, it would be tempting to hand over those levers to a new set of handlers, agents, reporters, and social media followers, with the hope that they continue to deliver monetary gain and external validation. But for all but a tiny fraction of Love Island stars, significant public interest, positive or negative, dissipates. Just as the show's intensity distills the timeline of love, The dense form of celebrity created over those 2 months has an accelerated life cycle after the show. ITV steers cast members toward representation that can advance their goals and interest. Couples who stay together might be able to prolong their spotlight. Barton Hansen says that her Love Island partner's manager actually said to me, "Oh, if you don't break up, you can make X, Y, and Z money together." But like John Clark, who became hugely, briefly famous and went on to star on the reality series The Only Way Is Essex, most islanders eventually have to move on from reality to real life. There's a big wide world out there, and it doesn't revolve around reality television, having everything done for you and having storylines, he says, of his decision to start companies specializing in meal kits and car window tinting. It takes you a bit of time to find your feet. For some of these contestants, nothing could have prepared them, Flack's colleague says. You get those people that are just like, what? Am I going to be known as the person who went on Love Island when I'm 60 and working in a pub and somebody's going to ask me to take a selfie? It's a conundrum because there's a huge amount of people who want to do shows like this because they're the experience of a lifetime. You can't totally know if somebody is going to be equipped for it. When I ask who has the resilience to withstand negative feedback, the source close to production says, I suppose people need to be sort of aware that things pass very quickly. You can be in the moment with something, and it can feel like it's probably never going to go away. Everything changes eventually, whether you're in the villa or watching at home. Paige Turley, the season 6 winner in South Africa, never met Flack. When she received her post-show press briefing, instead of hearing negative stories about herself, she says, a lot of their news was with the passing of Caroline. Turley got out of the villa, enjoyed several weeks of positive media coverage and fan interactions, and immediately went with her boyfriend into COVID lockdown. People, she says, were interested in the boringest things that we'd done. When Turley shared those boringest things, it was all on her terms. Re-entry during the early pandemic, with the world distracted by more paradigm-altering events than who had sex under the comforter, made for a gentler landing. 2.5 years later, with this summer season soon to start, there's a fresh crop of islanders to bare their hearts and asses for ITV and for us. When they are done with the villa and back on the outside, they will reunite with the people they were marooned from, return to old lives that are forever changed. They will be left to figure out how to use what they learned on Love Island and how to keep, for as long as they can, more than they gave up. virtual reality. Gabby Petito and Brian Laundry desperately wanted to forge a future together as social media influencers. They wouldn't become household names, though, until Laundry brutally murdered Petito and tried to get away with it. Here, true crime author Kathleen Hale forensically reconstructs their relationship up through Petito's last moments, drawing only on the breadcrumbs that the couple left online. They used the internet as a diary, a resume, a camera, and a mirror, and in their deaths, it became the truest reflection of their lives. Illustrations by Hokyung Kim. Opening illustration shows a van traveling through a mountain forest. When 23-year-old Brian Laundry and his 22-year-old girlfriend Gabby Petito went hiking, Brian insisted on walking barefoot. If it were up to him, Brian said, he wouldn't even own shoes. He'd become intent on living with less and encouraged Gabby to join him in a more natural lifestyle. He wanted her to build up her feet so that she, too, could ditch her shoes at the campsite. Sometimes Gabby humored him and slipped off her shoes during their walks, but she would inevitably put them back on. The grounds of the national parks were blisteringly hot and rife with black widow spiders. There was also the matter of dirty feet. Brian and Gabby were on a cross-country road trip in a small van. When Brian returned to the campsite barefoot, he tracked dirt into the vehicle where they slept and made food. Gabby preferred to keep the area clean. One day, about 5 weeks into their road trip, Gabby and Brian were hiking up 3 miles of steep terrain to the Delicate Arch, a rock formation in Utah's Arches National Park. As advised by the park's website, they had set out early in the morning to try to beat the heat. But by 6 a.m., it was already 91 degrees, and the day was only getting hotter. Despite Brian's hard-earned calluses, his bare feet likely burned. Gabby pranced beside him in her cushioned yet breathable REI hiking shoes. By 7 a.m., a small crowd was gathered around the Delicate Arch, admiring the view. Using her rubber soles for purchase, Gabby climbed onto a bare rock to get an unobstructed photo of the arch. As she stood there, snapping pictures, other tourists gathered around her. Gabby was beautiful, with blonde hair and blue eyes that matched the turquoise stone on her thumb ring. She looked good in photos. She looked good taking photos. A man in the crowd called up to Gabby, asking how she liked her REI shoes. Gabby got the sense that the man worked for REI, which was exciting. She dreamed of traveling full-time in her little Ford van, and other people had shown it was possible, subsisting on sponsorships from brands just like REI, documenting their voyages in converted buses with children and dogs in tow. Those with moderate social media followings got free camping gear and other supplies to feature in their post, which defrayed carrying cost. Some charged $100 per 10,000 followers. Others negotiated harder and could make as much as $700,000 in 6 months. Gabby didn't need a lot of money. She just wanted a chance to support herself while living her dreams. And now the first step, a chance for a potential sponsorship, was right at her feet. While Brian stood at the edge of the crowd, likely waiting for someone to ask him how he'd hiked all that way barefoot, Gabby launched into a well-received presentation to everyone below about how awesome her shoes were. Later, REI would reach out to her directly, saying they hoped the rest of her hike had gone well. Brian was not as supportive. Lately, he'd been trying to convince Gabby that she couldn't make a website by herself. Sometimes he made her feel like she couldn't do anything right. But now, all at once, she seemed to be on the right path. Maybe Brian didn't know everything. About 2 weeks later, Brian drove back to Florida alone. He parked in his parents' driveway and stayed for about 2 weeks before he grabbed a bag and ducked back into the humid air. Telling his mom and dad that he was off for one of his usual hikes at the nearby Carlton Reserve, a 24,565-acre state park that police would later describe as vast and unforgiving. Over the next few weeks, local law enforcement would spend $200,000 per day searching for Brian in the endless swamps. They waded up to their chest. Water moccasins slithered past. Alligators splashed nearby. The park was infested with rattlesnakes and wild hogs. The Florida panther stalked there, too. Some speculated that life on the lam would be relatively easy for Brian, given his self-professed camping skills. People who'd met him would remember him saying he'd spent months living off the land on the Appalachian Trail. It was easy to picture him hunched in the bush somewhere, eating gator meat with his hands and building pit fires at night to avoid sending up smoke signals. But others countered that perhaps Brian was not as outdoorsy as he seemed. His sister Cassie described his survival skills as mediocre. Law enforcement officials went further, profiling Brian as a spoiled boy who'd been coddled by his parents far too long to withstand any of the suffering endured by true survivalists. One former FBI agent theorized that Brian may have escaped on a cruise ship. Some said police were chasing a ghost. So, which was it? Was Brian Laundrie a phony who'd been eaten alive by the elements before he could even rig a shelter? Or had he embarked on the first real adventure of his life, sleeping during the day, hiking at night, and finally wearing shoes so he could run? Next photo shows a woman walking with ocean and sky behind her. Gabby Petito was a Pisces, an astrological sign known for being bad with boundaries, excessively romantic, and unable to remember at times whether something had actually happened or if she'd simply dreamed it. She loved sunflowers, butterflies, the color aqua blue, the Beatles song, Let It Be, and marijuana, which narrowed her turquoise eyes into shimmering green slivers and made her hungry for M&Ms. A little boy for whom Gabby babysat later described her as someone just living with rainbows. She did things to the beat of her own drum, his mom agreed. She was beautiful, in other words, inside and out, which is another way of saying that she was kind to ugly people. Gabby's classmate, Brian Laundrie, was 40 pounds overweight, with an underbite that made it look like he kept chewing tobacco in his lower lip. He sat alone in the cafeteria, identifying with the phrase, "Eat the spaghetti to forget your regretty." Brian struggled with anxiety. Kids who claimed to know him later described his life as lonely. But over time, Brian grew to like being alone. He took long hikes by himself, finding meaning in the part of the Seventh Seal when Max von Sydow's character says, "Through my indifference for people, I've been placed outside of their society. Now I live in a ghost world, enclosed in my dreams and imaginings." Survivalism fascinated him. Over the course of his life, Brian made more drawings than friends. He was a skilled copycat artist, rendering faithful facsimiles of his favorite cartoons and comic books. He carved lanacuts of images traced from the covers of Chuck Palahniuk novels. He screen-printed T-shirts with faces of popular animated characters like Bart Simpson and Hellboy. "I will actually attribute all of my skill in painting to dissecting the works of Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy," Brian later boasted. "I have never attended any schooling for art, but because of my love of comics, I never needed a second in a classroom." After entering high school, Brian decided to change. He adjusted his hairstyle and made a few friends who shared his interest in guns and stuff. Still, Brian struggled socially. "Why did I say that? Why did I say anything I have ever said?" he sometimes wondered. "How am I supposed to tell friends about my mental health without feeling like a burden?" Ultimately, Brian decided, "I gotta worry about my zen." He got into yoga. He lost 40 pounds. By his junior year, he found the courage to talk to Gabby Petito. Personality-wise, the two were opposites. Gabby was an extrovert. People described her as a bright light, whereas Brian's idea of socializing involved having one or two people over to play with UV paint in the dark. Sometimes he hated the entire human species. But Gabby loved the beach, and that gave them something to discuss. When the two first started talking, Brian's parents had just purchased a new Florida vacation house in Sarasota County. A popular travel destination for college kids on a spring break. Brian's parents owned a couple of properties, actually. The one in Northport, Florida, had a swimming pool, and Brian had his own bedroom there with a life-size Darth Vader helmet on one of the shelves. Gabby loved Star Wars. He also had a baseball hat collection and a patriotic red, white, and blue gun decorated in stars and stripes. Next illustration shows a man and woman holding hands, hiking through tall grass with trees in the background. Gabby and Brian differed in their views on guns. Brian's family collected them, while Gabby had once starred in a local artist low-budget music video, Irreplaceable, commemorating the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. But the two agreed on certain fundamentals. Littering was bad. Forensic Files, a television show about violent crimes that are solved using forensic science, was good. They reminded each other of Frog and Toad, a collection of children's stories about two seemingly incompatible best friends. A sleek, dashing frog who is demonstrative and cheerful, and a toad, a mottled and stouter individual who is more solemn and occasionally disappears to be by himself. So Brian and Gabby became friends, and perhaps to Brian's chagrin, they would stay just friends for years. More than 90% of graduates from Bayport Blue Point High School went on to attend college, but in keeping with their reputations as nonconformist, Gabby and Brian decided on a different route. After graduation, Gabby embarked to Cape Fear, North Carolina, allegedly to follow a boyfriend, while Brian found work at a local Long Island garden center, where he lectured his co-worker, Michael, on the benefits of yoga, and was known for always having clean hands, despite the fact that part of his job was supposed to entail working with plants and soil. "I thought he was this weirdo," Michael later recalled. "He never came across as the kind of person that would be the killing type. But he did have that tendency to be, I don't want to say the wrong thing, and make him sound worse than he already is. He was kind of a guy who would get pissed off pretty quick." In Cape Fear, Gabby worked at a seaside restaurant called Smoke on the Water, where she made countless friends, and worked in a hot kitchen, frying pickles and smoking brisket. Eventually, her pretty face and sparkling personality earned her a front-of-house hostess position. She loved the ocean and the Carolina Beach boardwalk. She applied to Cape Fear Community College, but never enrolled. At the time, Brian was allegedly couch surfing back in Long Island. His parents had sold their home and taken off to Florida, leaving Brian, who wanted to stay in Bayport, to live off generous former classmates. By then, he'd made a few close female friends, all of whom considered him like a brother. Brian lived with one of those girls for 6 months and continued couch surfing until Gabby returned home. It was almost as if he was waiting for her. Gabby returned to Suffolk County in January 2019. Winter on the south shore of Long Island paled in comparison to what Gabby had seen in Cape Fear. She longed to travel again. Ever since meeting Brian during her sophomore year, she'd felt like, I just want to do fun, cute, adventurous shit with someone. Brian felt the same. The two started hooking up that July. For their first real date, they ate sushi on the beach, wearing aqua blue sweatshirts that matched Gabby's eyes. To Gabby and Brian's high school friends, the relationship seemed toxic from the start. One minute they'd be all over each other, a friend later recalled. The next minute he'd be like, we're fighting. They always had some drama. As someone who lit up a room, Gabby inspired envy wherever she went. Her female friends from high school were more like enemies. At best, they wanted to be her, and at worst, they sneered at Gabby, pushing her away when she came to them with problems. Why can't I have a relationship like that, they wondered, whenever things between Gabby and Brian seemed to be going well. But when the relationship was rocky, the same girls ridiculed, oh my God, just break up and spare yourself from the drama and everyone else from having to hear about it. No one doubted that Brian, in his own suffocating way, loved Gabby. But his insecurities warped his idea of what counted as romantic. When Gabby visited Brian at the garden center and chatted with Michael, Brian would come up behind her, draping one of his conspicuously clean hands over Gabby's shoulder and pull her in for a kiss that left everyone but him feeling awkward. It likely upset Brian that Gabby's parents still thought the two were friends. Why was Gabby keeping him a secret? Brian wanted everyone to know that Gabby belonged to him. That fall, a decision was made. Brian and Gabby would quit their jobs and travel full-time for a few months. They drove from Long Island to California, stopping in Texas, where Gabby wore sweatpants that said, "Stop looking at my dick," and Colorado, where Gabby raved about the marijuana. With a lollipop in one hand and a vape pen in the other, she climbed Pike's Peak until the air around her felt thin. While Brian drove the Nissan Sentra, she sat in the passenger seat, a blunt pinched between her thumb and forefinger. Green prairie whipped by on either side. Sorry, New York, she thought, but you're nothing compared to this. At night, they slept in Walmart parking lots, reclined in Gabby's Nissan, and watched shooting stars through the windshield. The trip ended at the Santa Monica Pier, where they rode what Brian called a Ferris wheel with a serious view, and Gabby asked Brian to photograph her standing in front of Zoltar, an animatronic fortune-telling machine. After the Santa Monica Pier reposted the photo on its official Instagram page, Gabby started to think that she might be able to make it as a travel blogger. Meanwhile, Brian likely wondered when Gabby would post a picture of him. For the entire trip, he'd been taking portraits of Gabby, which she posted on Instagram. But Gabby would not upload any photos of Brian until March 17, 2020, nearly 8 months into their relationship. High school acquaintances who followed their 2019 cross-country trip online were likely surprised to learn that Brian had been on the journey at all. At times, Brian might have felt uncertain about whether he was Gabby's boyfriend or her photographer. He surveyed the dirty, polluted streets of Los Angeles and decided, L.A. sucks. But on the windy beach in Santa Monica, Gabby's hair tickled his face. The blue sky reflected in her sunglasses, and it hit Brian that he'd never loved anyone so much in his entire life. Almost as soon as they arrived back to Long Island, Brian convinced Gabby to move with him to Florida. They could stay at one of his parents' properties rent-free and spend all their time together like an extension of their road trip. At first, it was fun. Gabby and Brian hung hammocks on the beach and painted flowers on an old piano they found on the street. But not long after they relocated south, Brian's parents sold the condo where Gabby and Brian had been staying for free, forcing them to move in with Brian's parents, who lived in a small yellow house surrounded by lawn ornaments. To secure his hold on Gabby, Brian proposed marriage. Gabby said yes. But Brian had no way to support his fiancée. He sold bookmarks online for $4 and hadn't had a real job in months. While researching alternative living arrangements, he briefly considered moving with Gabby into a storage container, but even that option turned out to be prohibitively expensive. Luckily, there was a solution to Brian's problem, a new craze called van life. Couples across the globe were making the decision to downsize their lives, trailblazing across countries in vans and filming the adventure for their followers on social media. Surely, Brian could convince Gabby to take the leap with him. She was an aspiring travel blogger. It was a win-win situation. In December 2020, Gabby, who'd been working consistently since her 2017 restaurant job in North Carolina, purchased a Ford Transit Connect van in her own name. Over the next few months, she and Brian worked hard to convert it into something resembling what they'd seen online. The popular van life vans had bathrooms and butcher block countertops. But it soon became clear that Brian and Gabby's van was too tiny for the tiny home they had envisioned. It had an extraneous row of seats in the middle. The remaining space in the back was too small even for Gabby, who was 5'5", to stand up or lie down. Even if they gutted the middle seats, an expensive process, a single mattress would fill up the entire vehicle. Where would they stuff their bags and their camping stove? Maybe they could build custom storage under the bed, but that cost money too. Reality hit hard. They had sunk Gabby's savings into a van that was essentially the same as Gabby's Nissan Sentra, only with a bigger trunk. There would be no kitchenette or toilet. They would need to cook and poop outside. Gabby was happy to invest more in the trip, but when she started working 50 hours a week at Taco Bell, Brian was furious. The idea of her ringing up burritos and jumbo sprites for other men likely irked him. He didn't want Gabby to work. He wanted her to spend all her time with him. Then Gabby and her new friend Rose, whom Gabby had met online, made plans to attend ladies' night at a local line dancing joint. Brian pleaded with Gabby to stay home. When that didn't work, he screamed at her, but Gabby grabbed her purse and left anyway. When Gabby was on her way to pick up Rose, she discovered that Brian had taken her ID. Gabby drove home to confront him. The fight escalated. Brian pushed her. She slapped him. To Brian's frustration, Gabby fled to Rose's house. There, Gabby confided in Rose that Brian suffered from what Gabby called episodes, in which he heard voices and couldn't fall asleep because they were so distracting. She told Rose that she and Brian fought a lot, and that the fights sometimes turned physical, but never anything outright violent, Gabby said, and she blamed herself for the altercations. Sensing Gabby was holding something back, Rose said, "You need to tell me the deep of what happened." When Gabby wouldn't, Rose gently coaxed Gabby to reconsider her engagement to Brian. "You're young, and Brian is a little controlling," Rose said, hastening to add, "but do whatever makes you happy, and I'm here to support you." Meanwhile, Brian stewed. Luring Gabby away from Long Island into a house where she would not need to pay rent had likely ensured in his mind that he would finally have Gabby to himself, with no outside obligations like family, friends, or work to divide her attention. Later, a longtime criminal profiler would say he suspected that Brian's entire self-worth was rooted in the relationship with Gabby, and that without her, he's got nothing. Then, in June 2021, Gabby's dad moved from New York to Vero Beach, Florida, in part to be closer to Gabby. Gabby's family didn't know about the screaming and shoving, but Gabby had confided in her mom, Nicole, that she felt like things were moving too fast. Gabby had been excited at first, she said, when Brian had initially proposed to her, but now she was starting to think, "We're very young." Gabby even told Nicole that she and Brian weren't engaged anymore. They were back to being boyfriend and girlfriend, though whether or not Gabby ever shared this with Brian is unknown. That same month, Brian decided that he and Gabby would start the road trip early. They embarked on July 2, 2021. Next illustration shows a woman sitting looking at Delicate Arch in Arches National Park, Utah. 1 month later, blistering heat, stinging flies, and unrelenting wildfire smoke were conspiring to drive Brian insane. Sleeping in a tent on account of the van's cramped quarters offered little protection from smoke inhalation, which is known to cause neurological issues like stress and confusion. Worse, Gabby's attention was divided between him and her phone as she generated content for Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. That she'd finally started posting pictures of him, along with loving captions, did little to lessen Brian's anger. The whole point of the road trip, in his mind, was to isolate Gabby, but thanks to the internet, she was connected to the world. The tension between them first snapped on August 12th, when Gabby retreated to an air-conditioned coffee shop in Moab for 6 hours to toil on their van life website, while Brian seethed across the table, pissed off at how OCD Gabby was being. Finally, he snatched Gabby's phone and keys and made for the van, threatening to abandon her. When Gabby caught up with him on Main Street and lunged for her phone, Brian slapped her in the face. A passing driver saw the slap and called 911, watching as Brian slid into the van and started the engine. Somehow, before he could drive away, Gabby managed to wriggle across his lap into the vehicle. Who knows what they talked about, speeding out of Moab. Brian was driving at 45 miles per hour in a 15-mile-per-hour zone. It wasn't long before police lights flashed in their rearview mirror. As a result of the 911 call, police were on the lookout for a white van with Florida plates. Officer Daniel Scott Robbins, who was nearing the end of his police training, had been trailing the van for about a mile. He wondered aloud if the driver was intoxicated. Once Brian pulled onto the shoulder of the road, Robbins parked behind him and approached on foot. Gabby rolled down the passenger window, her face red and wet with tears, and apologized profusely. Brian smiled as if nothing was wrong. "How come you're crying?" Robbins asked Gabby. Brian eyed Gabby warily from the driver's seat. "Some personal issues," she said. "It was a long day," Brian interjected, talking so fast that Robbins would later ponder whether he might be on drugs. "Flies and stuff." Robbins invited Gabby to talk to him in private. She stood hunched near Robbins' squad car, unable to stop crying, already blaming herself for the altercation. "It's just, some days, I have really bad OCD." It was unclear whether a doctor or Brian had diagnosed her with the disease. Sounding kind and patient, Robbins asked about the road trip. Gabby stood up a little straighter. She gestured at the van with both hands like a presenter on Wheel of Fortune. "I quit my job to travel across the country." Suddenly, her face crumpled as if she might cry again, as if overwhelmed by the prospect of what she said next. "I'm trying to start a blog, so I've been building websites, and I've just been really stressed." She gazed up at the sky as if to keep the tears back with gravity. "But he doesn't really believe that I could do any of it," her voice quavered. "He really stresses me out." "Well," Robbins interjected, "why don't we do this? Why don't I sit you down in the back seat of my car?" Tears filled Gabby's eyes, The prospect of getting into a squad car terrified her. She seemed to think she was in trouble. "You're not in any trouble," Robbins promised. Then he amended himself, "I'm not going to be putting handcuffs on you." The mention of handcuffs made it seem as if Gabby were, in fact, in trouble. Not enough trouble to require handcuffs, but trouble nonetheless. As more squad cars pulled up behind them, Robbins shut her in the back of his police cruiser, the same place where criminals sat. Staring through the unbreakable divider, Gabby would not have been able to open the door from the inside. The notion that she was not in any trouble was, understandably, in question for her, as she watched Robbins approach her beloved white van to talk to Brian. Brian leaned forward nervously in his seat, talking to Robbins through the passenger window. "You talked to Gabby, right?" Brian asked. One of his thick eyebrows vaulted above the other. He wrung his fingers in knots, looking afraid. Robbins left him hanging. "Let's go ahead and get you to step out of the vehicle, all righty?" Moments later, Robbins questioned Brian on the roadside. "You want to tell me about the scratches on your face?" Brian had two tiny red cuts, one on his right temple, about a centimeter in length, and one underneath his right eye, the size of a pinprick. "She gets really worked up sometimes," Brian said. "What happened this morning was that she was trying to set up a little website blog," he mimed typing, "so I gave her time. We really had a nice morning, but she just got worked up as we were trying to get going. She had a cell phone in her hand. That's why I was pushing her away." Robbins didn't ask why Gabby's cell phone provoked pushing, or why Brian would lock Gabby out of a van that was registered in her name. "I know I shouldn't push her," Brian said. A male park ranger had joined them by this point, and Brian turned to him beseechingly. "I was just trying to push her away to go, let's just take a minute, step back and breathe." He pointed to the scratches on his face. "She got me." When Robbins headed back to his vehicle, he found Officer Eric Pratt, a big man with a beard, talking to Gabby. "Did he hit you, though?" Pratt was asking. Gabby cried, indicating that he had, but she had hit him first, she claimed. Her account didn't match the 911 caller's, but the men had not listened to the 911 call. They decided that Gabby had been the primary aggressor in her altercation with Brian. Pratt joined Brian at the van, pointed a jaunty finger at him, and announced, "You are the victim of domestic assault," causing Brian to laugh out loud. Pratt, citing the importance of being anti-sexist, because women can victimize men too, quickly enlisted Robbins, an inferior-ranking officer, to get Brian a hotel for the night. His room would be paid for by Seekhaven, the local women's shelter. Gabby could sleep outside. Before leaving Gabby alone in the wilderness, Robbins asked whether she had any messages of love to convey to Brian, coaxing, "Want me to let him know that you love him and that you'll see him tomorrow?" Gabby didn't answer. In a squeaky voice, rusty from tears, she said, "Make sure he doesn't forget a phone charger." Back at the van, Brian seemed psyched about the hotel, gushing to a male park ranger, "Thank you, thank you." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections. by Mark Hoffman.